This is a HeadGum Podcast.
While Andrew and Craig believe the joy of discovery is crucial to enjoying any well-told tale, they will not shy away from spoiling specific story beats when necessary. Plus, these are books you should have read by now.
Let's talk about some dead dogs.
Great. That sounds perfect for the beginning of the holiday season. Let's talk about dead dogs.
Jingle bells, your dog is dead. Da, 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 da,
da. I mean, isn't that what happens in that holiday episode of The Simpsons?
No, they get a dog.
Oh.
That's the opposite of a dog dying.
That's the opposite of a dog dying is getting a new dog. Welcome to Overdue. It's a podcast about the books that you've been meaning to read. My name is Craig.
My name is Andrew.
And each week we talk about a book. Usually one of us has read it for the show, and they're going to talk to the other person who may or may not have read the book in question. This week, the book in question is Where the Red Fern Grows by Wilson Rawls.
Rawls.
And if you've ever heard about this book, or if you've read it, you know it's sad, and it involves dogs.
We won't say what happens to the dogs that makes the book sad.
I think we're going to have to say what happens to the dogs that makes the book sad.
Well, the joke also is that we already...
Oh, sure.
We already said the thing. so this wasn't... So from talking to people on Twitter, I think maybe this is more of like an Appalachian thing and a Midwestern thing, but this book is required reading in grade school for a lot of people. It was for me.
It wasn't
for you.
It wasn't me, but I don't know if that's a regionalism or just the teachers that I had.
It could be either way. We're dealing with an extremely small sample size.
Yeah, I don't really
but
know.
In that same grade school, like, sad dog book run where you're reading, like, Shiloh and Old Yeller.
Yeah, other books.
You also get Where the Red Fern Grows, because I guess teachers figure that the best way to teach kids about mortality is for it to be just a pet. A dead pet.
Well, and I have some thoughts about that as it relates to this book, but the other like sad dog books. And so like we've kind of front-loaded this podcast by talking about the fact that dogs in this book are going to die. And
there is a little thing at the beginning that said spoilers might happen, and just because we don't always start the podcast by saying
the
biggest
big
spoiler.
But there is an early passage in the book that alludes to the fact that this book is going to deal with, quote, death in its saddest form. So I think
the dog kind.
Yeah, I'll revisit that quote in just a second. But yeah, I think if you're like a dog lover or something and you really just can't handle stories where bad things happen to pets, like, I get it. And maybe like
this is
shy
not,
away
this is
from
yet. Emphatically not the book for you.
Maybe just shy away from the end of this discussion when I talk about exactly what goes down, because it was pretty shocking to me having read this book for the first time. But there are other books that I think other people like think of. So there's like Sounder. I don't know if the dog dies in Sounder, but I remember Sounder. There's Old Yeller, as
Sounder,
you said.
I've never heard of that one.
Shiloh. There's The Art of Racing in the Rain, which is apparently a sad dog book. Marley and Me, of course.
Oh, sure.
My Dog Skip. There's that movie that just came out called A Dog's Purpose, which is based off of a book that's like that
the
dog
dog's
that gets
purpose
reincarnated.
Is apparently to make you really attached to it and then to die.
And it's just a universal thing. Humans have had pets forever and ever and ever, and we are sad when we lose them because we project our humanness onto them.
And to be not serious, but a little more serious, is that pets have a much shorter lifespan than humans, and so if you're a pet lover, one, you're going to experience this form of death several
times.
Yeah,
that's true. Unless you love parrots, because parrots live like
parrots
forever.
Parrots apparently live forever. And often, I think, like I know my first big experience with death as a kid was a pet death.
Mm.
Like, and then that depends on a lot of factors, but I think that is a lot of kids' like first real emotional reckoning with a thing that existed and that you loved and then stops existing.
Yeah, and what do you do about that, and what lessons do you learn from that? So let's talk about Wilson Rawls, and then we'll get back to this book and all the pet death wearing.
And all the dead dogs in it.
So he was born in 1913, died 1984, I think.
Yes, that is correct. And he was he was 16 during the Great Depression, and this was a formative experience for him. He basically, his family almost lived out Grapes of Wrath. His family attempted to go to California from Oklahoma to find a job, but their car broke down in New Mexico, and his dad like found a job in a toothpaste factory and made things work from there. Rawls then, when he was working in his 30s and 40s as a carpenter, he actually wrote 5 manuscripts, but he was pretty embarrassed about them because the grammar and punctuation was not great. Like, he wasn't a trained writer.
Yeah.
And later on, when he met the person he would marry, he didn't want her to know about like his perceived failures as a writer, and so he burns these 5 manuscripts.
Yeah, before they get married, he burns them.
Right. And then later on, he says, he confesses to her, "Hey, I wanted to be a writer, but I got rid of these manuscripts." And she apparently, and this is all like sourced from an interview that we can't listen to, it's like cited, but it's some interview that we don't have the like primary source from. So she encourages him to write again. He sits down and writes out the manuscript for Where the Red Fern Grows, because he basically says he had it memorized. Like, he writes it out in 3 weeks. She submits it to the Saturday Evening Post, who rejects it. She then sends it to the Ladies' Home Journal, which writes back and says, "Hey, this isn't good for us, but what if we submitted it to the Saturday Evening Post?"
Oh, good. Great.
And then it was published in the Post as The Hounds of Youth in 1961. Doubleday later picked it up, tried to market it to adults, did not go great. And then someone had the idea to introduce it to like a conference of teachers and librarians, who then took it to students, who then made it a staple of elementary schools that it is today. So that's the basic story of him in this book. There's not like a lot on him. The other book that he's known for is called Summer of the Monkeys, which is a pretty good name. I don't know anything about that book, but I want to just imagine a plot to it.
Yeah, I don't want to tell you.
Unless it's about like a boy who gets some pet monkeys who die heroically late in the book.
I'm just looking at the Wikipedia summary, and it does involve a boy, his sister, and drunken monkeys that befriend him. So,
sounds like a pretty good sophomore effort.
Pretty good book. That's really what he's known for. There is a statue of Billy Coleman from this book, Where the Red Fern Grows, and his dogs at the Idaho Falls Public Library. Which is where I think Wilson Rawls ended up spending some time, and where the narrator of this book might as well be Wilson Rawls, but like, you know, Billy Coleman is the character, and it opens with him like looking back on his youth with these dogs.
And he also, like, the last thing to note about him probably is that he also had a career as a motivational speaker. He spoke at over 2,000 schools in 22 states, and he had advice for any children who wanted to be a writer, because, you know, he's of course not a trained writer. He's not like writerly, but he still found success as a writer. He says, "Children are always asking me what advice I can give them on trying to be a writer. I always tell them to do a lot of reading, read and study creative writing, then start writing and keep writing, and then they can be a writer too. Someday they will make it if they don't give up." And I feel like that advice is not original, but it is seriously, really, truly the best advice you can give to anybody who wants to write, is really like, just do it. Don't try not to get like hung up on like writer's block or making the perfect idea or whatever. Like, the only way you're going to get to you're not going to sit down and have your debut novel like flow flawlessly out of your magic fingers. Like it's going to be a lot of trial and error. It's going to be a lot of just like hunting around and honing your skill and that kind of stuff. I do really sympathize with, I identify with, like, he wouldn't let his wife read the manuscript to Where the Red Fern Grows until it was done.
Yeah, sure.
And I, too, cannot give anybody anything creative that I have done to look at before I feel like it is done. And I can take edits from there and make it more done, but I need to feel like it is at least, like, first draft done
before
I can let anybody look at it.
Yeah. Yeah, he seems like a dude who just kind of did his thing. And lived his life and had these books. I'm surprised that there were not more books from him, but
yeah, I'm curious about like if assuming that Summer of the Monkeys also was a manuscript that he burned that he later revived. Like, I wonder what those other books were about. Like, maybe it's fine that we don't have them, but I am just like curious.
Yeah, three of them he really meant to burn because they were bad,
right?
And then two of them he went on and wrote again because he really liked them. Mm-hmm. That's possible.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a quick break and we'll dive into the book proper. What do you think?
I think that sounds just fine.
Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Greg.
This week's sponsor is us.
You're holding up that dumb pencil that says Rick or Treat.
That's true. I do have a pencil that says Rick or Treat.
It said Trick or Treat and then a T wore off. That's the funny story of Craig's pencil.
Yes.
But yeah, your Overdue is brought to you this week by Overdue, the podcast about the books you've been meaning to read. Go to overduepodcast.com/store and you'll find some of their great merchandise, mugs, tote bags, bookmarks, stickers, discounted for the holiday season.
And this store would not exist if not for our lovely Patreon donors. So thank you to them. If you want to know more about that, because there's a bonus episode coming later this week that you could get early if you're a Patreon donor, you go to patreon.com/overduepod. We talk about it at the end of every show. But yeah, the store is up and there's some cool stuff there. And you should go get it because it's cool.
It is cool.
That's all we have to say about that.
I have nothing else to say about our merchandise. I'm very sorry that the Try to Be Happy mug is sold out because it's very popular and that's why it's sold out.
True. But we wanted you to have another shot to get some of this stuff. So head on over there. It's overduepodcast.com/store. Get it now before it's gone.
It's gone forever until next time.
So, Andrew, you have read this book. You read it in school?
I read it back in elementary school. I read it once of my own accord, and I think once along with the rest of the class.
And so do you have a decent memory of it? Do you remember it making you cry?
I don't know if it made me cry, because I don't remember that.
Sure.
Okay. I feel like I don't even remember if I cried like a normal person until a certain age. Or if I always was like crying resistant, but it's
sure.
Like I remember it being super sad.
It is a sad book,
obviously,
so
but I don't remember
up.
if it manifested like physically.
Okay, that's fine. Well, here's something that's gonna bum you out right away from the beginning of this book, and this is our narrator Billy Coleman talking in what I presume is like the 60s when he's an adult. And this is the beginning of the book. When I left my office that beautiful spring day, I had no idea what was in store for me. To begin with, everything was too perfect for anything unusual to happen. It was one of those days when a man feels good, feels like speaking to his neighbor, is glad to live in a country like ours and proud of his government. You know what I mean? One of those rare days when everything is right and nothing is wrong.
How long has it been? Man, what a strange, as an adult, like what a strange sentence.
What a strange.
I can't imagine leaving my like data entry job and be like, man, what a perfect day. My government is great. Like, everything's going good.
Now, I'm trying to think. It was written where pre-civil rights, where we're like getting into the civil rights era, but like pre-civil rights legislation. When did Kennedy die?
63.
So Kennedy isn't dead yet.
Has he been elected yet?
Book was published in 61.
Right, but when was it written?
Unclear.
So it's probably an Eisenhower 50s. Thing.
Yeah, probably an Ike thing. He probably liked Ike.
He liked Ike. I think most people liked Ike.
Yeah, that's why they used that phrase. I like Ike. They wouldn't have used it if most people didn't like him.
I don't know, man. Fake news.
So the book opens. He's feeling great, and he sees this old, what is called raccoon hunting hound, in the street getting attacked by a bunch of dogs. And he takes it home, and he feeds it, and he takes care of it, and then he lets it go. And then he says, although the old hound had no way of knowing it, he had stirred memories, and what priceless treasures they were. Memories of my boyhood days, an old Casey baking powder can, and two little red hounds. Memories of a wonderful love, unselfish devotion, and as I said before, death in its saddest form. So right away, this book is not pulling punches. It is letting you know that he is going to get some dogs and somebody's going to die.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, buckle up is what's happening here. What I also like about this, though, is there is this, what I think one of the things that is useful about this book from a like part of its themes and why you might encourage a kid to read it is that by opening with this narrator who is an adult who feels good about his government and is walking around in the world, he also was a kid who suffered like kid loss and experienced the things that if you're a teenager or you're a tween or whatever, and you're like, ah, no one understands me. Like this book has a little bit of like, yeah, but every adult has a story like that. And you might be able to build a bridge to like your parents or something, where you think that they don't feel the way that you do about whatever you're going through.
Mm-hmm.
So the book, this dog reminds him of his childhood in the Ozarks of Oklahoma.
And also death in its saddest form. Just like, yes. Lest we forget.
Lest we forget. And I find it interesting, the family, Billy Coleman's family, live on Cherokee land, he mentions, because his mother has Cherokee ancestry. And I don't think about that when I think about the Ozarks, which is mostly my own naivete and lack of knowledge. But it's also interesting because the book does do a lot of referencing of like faith and superstition, and it draws on a few legends that are like quote unquote Indian as they're written in this book.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably just the use of the word at that time in the 50s. I don't know if you would write it differently today. I can't speak for Wilson Rawls on that front. But it was interesting to me that was pointed out and then kind of like dropped other than some of these like legends and superstitions that crop up later.
Right. So I don't remember it being like integral to the flow of the book, but
mm-mm. It does explain why they basically live on this plot of land that is otherwise removed from town. So Billy, I think he has three younger sisters and his two parents, and they just kind of live off the land. Like his grandpa has a store in town. It's not a very big town, but Billy can just run around in the woods all day. Like that's what he does. He doesn't go to school. When he turns 11, he starts helping his dad with chores on the farm. But other than that, he's just kind of a kid who lives in the woods.
Right.
And I don't think that would be the case if they were not living on this particular plot of land, though, of course, the family, I think, would love to eventually move into town and like start sending their kids to school.
Mm-hmm.
So Billy is a young boy at the beginning of this book. He's 10, and he is struck with puppy love. As the book specifies, it's not...
Is that love of a puppy?
Yes, it is. It says not the kind of feeling when you want like a girl in your class to kiss you, but like he wants a dog. And it's interesting because I had two dogs growing up, but I don't remember being a kid who was like give me a dog. I need a dog. I want a dog for Christmas. Why don't we have a dog? Like, I just never remember being that kid. Were you?
No, I mean, we never had dogs. I've been a cat person, like cat person till I die.
Ride or meow. What? Meow or die?
Meow or die. Until I experience death in its saddest form, which is what it will be when I die. I'm a cat person, but okay. Yeah. Our first cat was definitely like driven by my dad. Like, he definitely 100% brought a kitten home without asking my mom about it.
Oh no!
And you know when you do that, and you have three young kids, you know what you're doing.
Yeah, because
they're gonna see that
around.
Kitty, and they're gonna go, "Oh, a kitty! Oh, it's so cute! I love it forever, or for always." And you're never going to be able to get rid of it, which is what happened until it died of feline leukemia.
Oh, no.
A few years later.
Oh, that's really sad.
And that was like death in like its second or third saddest form, I think.
Yeah, I grew up with cats. We always had cats. And I only remember one of them really personally affecting me. But we also had dogs. We got a dog like right after my parents split up. And then we might have talked about this on the podcast before, but that dog,
I feel like I've talked about the cat thing too. But
that dog got hit by a car when we went outside to see Santa Claus on a fire truck, and that was very sad.
So Santa did it.
Santa killed my dog.
Santa. You must have been really bad that year. Like, what did you do?
We didn't go out to see Santa on a fire truck for years after that.
Because he killed your dog. Why
did.
Would you?
He did. He did not personally run it over with his fire truck, but he did cause that dog to die. And then we had another dog. We had a dog named Tramp, who was just a bad dog, and we ended up taking him back, like sending him back to a place where he could get adopted by people who could handle him.
After how long?
Like a year or two.
Wow.
Like, he just like never got house trained and was really mean and stuff. And then apparently when I was a little boy, I don't remember this, we had like a big dog that was my mom's called Sergeant. He apparently was a cool dog, but I didn't know anything about him. It's a pretty good dog name. I've been told that he was a big dog and I used to feed him cheese puffs, but I don't really know anything about that. But Billy Coleman in this book, he doesn't want any old dog. He gets offered like a mongrel and he doesn't want it. He wants some raccoon hunting hounds, and they are expensive dogs. And his puppy fever gets so bad that he starts to like lose weight, and his mom is like, "You need to cut this out because you're like not eating. I can't buy you a dog because of your hunger strike. Like, cut it out." And his dad, instead of getting him a dog, gets him like some traps so that he can go around like trapping stuff. Like,
so he thinks like, "Oh, you want a coon hound so you can catch raccoons. I can't give you a dog, but I can help you catch raccoons."
Well, the traps aren't big enough for raccoons, but he can catch like squirrels. He catches the family cat a couple of times. But at night he starts hearing a hound out in the woods, and he really just starts freaking out and really like getting very antsy about it.
Mm-hmm.
So he turns 11. He's working in the fields with his dad, and some fishermen like leave their camp and don't really clean up after themselves. And he goes over there. He's like, "Oh, I'll get some supplies." Basically like raiding something in any video game where like people used to be here. And you're like,
right,
"Oh."
You just like look down at the knapsack and you press A and you get like chips and money out of it and stuff.
Yes.
Yeah.
And one of the things he finds is a Sportsman magazine that has an ad for dogs. And there's a Kentucky kennel that is just advertising bloodhounds for $25 each. And I've never heard of a magazine where you could buy dogs. I assume that exists. I did go on.
I'm just going to do some Googling. I'm going to see if there's like a dog fancy magazine.
Well, I did. While you find that.
Dogs magazine now.
You can buy bloodhound puppies for like $600 to $2,000 on the American Kennel Marketplace. What did you find?
There's a lot of good names of magazines that are about dogs.
Okay,
get this. There's Dogs Life.
Uh-huh.
There's a Dogster.
Yep.
There's Modern Dog.
Oh,
and
no.
My personal favorite, Gun Dog Magazine.
Whoa! No way.
check out Gundog Magazine.
Gundog Magazine.
Gundog Magazine was created for owners of... Gundog Magazine is the go-to guide for individuals who own hunting dogs. Each issue covers dog breeds, training gear, accessories, and health. Whether you own a hunting dog or are thinking about buying one, you will appreciate each new issue of Gundog Magazine. Published 7 times a year, Gundog provides comprehensive coverage of hunting dogs. Each issue focuses on the various types of breeds, from the American Brittany's to the Irish Setters. The publication gives an in-depth look at the similarities and differences among the breeds. Gundog also contains extensive advice on how to train hunting dogs, from how to prevent dogs from whining to how to train a bird dog for shed hunting. I don't know what any of that is.
Nope.
Gundog is filled with authoritative content from experts. So, print is dying. And it just does not seem like this is an industry where things would change enough frequently enough.
Sure.
For there to be a 7-issue-a-year magazine.
Unless there's like
dogs.
Yeah, unless there's like a gun dog of the month, like, and the dog gets to like write an article for each magazine. That I would be into.
I don't, on the cover, I don't see like a gun dog of the month, but there are 6 pages of reader's puppy photos in there,
yes.
Which feels like filler. This particular issue I'm looking at is the annual Puppy Spectacular issue of Gundog Magazine.
So I did make some notes about this though. So I ended up on some hunting websites as I was looking this up, and I have never hunted. It is not an experience that I identify with at all. And I know that there's a rich tradition of it here in America in particular. And part of that, I was doing some research. I ended up on NorthAmericanWhitetail.com, which mm-hmm. is a website all about hunting deer. And, you know, we've been using dogs and other animals to hunt with us for, you know, 15,000 years. And the weird thing, the interesting thing about like American hunting is that when Europeans emigrated to the Americas, they were leaving lands that were like owned by royals, and those were the only people who could hunt, like the upper class landowner class. And so they come to this new land that they're already taking from the people that are already here.
And like, we can kill anything we want.
Exactly.
Whenever we want.
And so we're just going
to... That sounds very American.
It is. And we're just going to hunt, hunt, hunt. And that's apparently, according to this article, which was written in 2010, there are still 11 states where you can use dogs to hunt deer. I don't know. It's interesting. That doesn't happen in this book. There are also websites where you can buy lion hunting dogs. And that those websites feel a little far right militia-y, that I closed those tabs very quickly. That I did not. I felt like I was about to like storm some public land.
Yeah,
it
I
didn't
feel like
seem great.
I
don't want to cast
like
aspersions
most
on people who do legal hunting, but
hunt
I didn't
lions
like where
with
I
their
went.
Dogs, but it does sound like the lion is the would be who I put my money on in a lion dog matchup
for the most part. Yeah,
I mean, if this like it depends on if the dog is like water type and the lion is like electric type or whatever. Like
yes.
If the type matchup is really important.
Yeah. What?
In any sort of fight between
Wait,
creatures like
are
this?
Are there electric type dogs?
Yeah.
Why not?
Like Jolteon's kind of a dog.
He is kind of a dog.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So our boy Billy Coleman, he spends literally, Andrew, he spends 2 years saving up for these dogs. I can't
I think taking 2 years to save up $50 also feels very American to me.
Yes. He's picking berries. He's grabbing crawfish. He's trapping small animals, and he's keeping all his money in an old baking powder can that he found in the garbage. And he tells his grandpa that he's saving up to buy these dogs. And his grandpa's like, okay, cool. Come back to me when you have the money. And 2 years later, he shows up and he tells his grandpa, hey, I want to buy these dogs out of this magazine that's 2 years old. And his grandpa calls the number and he's like, well, good news. The dogs are $40 now. Yeah.
Boy, dogs depreciate, I guess.
Yeah, there's a line about the dog industry not doing as well, I guess, which is weird. But so he has to go into town, into like the big town, to get the dogs when they come into like the train depot or whatever.
So not the little town where his grandpa has a store.
Not the little town where his
like
grandpa
the city.
Has a store. The sort of the city. It's a train depot town in Oklahoma.
Sure.
And he goes there. He doesn't tell his parents that he bought dogs. And he sneaks away
This is definitely a forgiveness, not permission situation.
Totally. He actually spends his leftover money on presents for his family as like some, it's a pretty good move, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I got to give it to Billy. It's a good
and
one.
And he comes into this town and there's a part where he sees himself in a store window, Andrew, and the book remarks upon it. He's 13 years old, and it's the first time he's ever seen his full reflection. Think about that.
I mean, my grandmother is from West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a possibly apocryphal story floating around in my family where like... She had a roommate early on in her adult life who also was from West Virginia, and she had her first experience with like wrapped cheese.
Oh,
like wrapped
sure.
American cheese.
Yeah.
As an adult.
All right.
I'm not trying to like it makes me sound like I'm judging people. It's just like you can't, especially in rural life, like back, you know, 70 to 80 years ago, however long ago this is supposed to be, like there are definitely amenities that not everybody would have access to.
And the way that this factors into what's happening with Billy is that he is then in this town where people are like making fun of him because he doesn't wear shoes. He's this like dirty, like explicitly called a hillbilly boy, who's never been to school. And, after he gets his dogs, like all these kids like make fun of him for carrying his puppies around in a bag, and they start calling him the dog boy, and they try to beat him up, but the marshal comes and stops them and like gives him a strawberry soda. It's like a whole thing. I don't know why you would beat up a kid for having puppies.
Because you're another kid and kids are the worst, I think, is the reason why.
Well, that is certainly another
kids
part of this book.
Kids very are very cruel, especially to anyone who's different. So.
That's true. And there is a thing. It's like if they're not judging you, they're laughing at you or something is what he says about like just being in town. He doesn't understand
laughing at you.
People.
Like the judgment is implied in the laughing.
Sure. And so he takes his pups back through the woods. And at one point, he has to, like, shack up in a cave, and he builds a fire, and he's, like, marveling at his little puppies. Oh, I forgot to mention, when he first gets the puppies, he just, like, cries about it. He just holds his puppies and cries. And I will say that that's something that I really do like about this book, is there is a, and I've jotted down a couple other parts, but, like, here's just this, like, early teen boy who gets overwhelmed with emotion at times.
Like, yeah, male emotion.
Yeah. And, like, I'm so excited for this thing, and it bubbles over, and it is... The book never really judges him for it. There's never a moment where someone's
been,
like...
He's been saving up for... Like, this has been all he's wanted for two years, and he finally has it. Like, of course he's gonna...
It's kind of cool. I will say I want to balance it out with there's a couple of beats throughout the book, including when like two young ladies giggle at him when he says like they couldn't help it, they were women folks, that you're like, if you're gonna like read this with a kid today, like maybe just like point out those little beats where you're like, this was written in the 60s. Like this is
a boy
from the early 60s saying some stuff. But he is a boy who can, like, in this, the book has room for him to be emotional about these dogs, right? He's going back, and again, he's in this cave. He hears a mountain lion out in the distance. Scares him a little bit, but it never shows up. And then as he's on his way back to his house, he realizes he doesn't have a name for these dogs, and he tries like Red and Bugle and Lead, which is a cool name for a dog that I'm sad.
Lead,
like
Lead
the
gun dog.
Lead the gun dog. And for the girl dog, he goes with like Susie, Mabel, or Queen. He doesn't like any of those. And then he sees just like carved on a tree the names Dan and Anne in a heart. Like two lovers out in the woods, which again, like, why are you bringing knives on a date? Like why are you doing that?
Two people did it under the tree in the woods, and they carved their names in it, and that's why he named his dogs that.
So he names his puppies Old Dan and Little Anne, and Old Dan is like clearly emerging as a tough dog, a good boy, but maybe not the brightest dog, and Little Anne is emerging as a really smart, wily, clever dog. and he brings them home. And of course, his parents are like, well, I guess you bought dogs. I guess we keep them now. And they're okay because he brought them presents, and that's fine. So now he's going to embark on coon hunting. He's going to catch a raccoon. And the first, what he has to do is he has to teach his dogs what raccoons smell like and what mm-hmm. they do.
Sure.
So he has his grandpa help him catch one with a trap. That is one of the like weirdest things. They take a log and there's like a hole in
it. I very clearly remember this because it like raccoons are so, you punk them so easily.
Yeah. So like the book makes a lot of hay out of how clever these raccoons are and all the tricks that they can do to escape dogs. But then grandpa's like, okay, put a hole in a log, put something shiny at the bottom of it, drive a bunch of nails into the log, and the raccoon is going to reach in there and grab the shiny thing, but then he can't pull his hand out because he's making a fist, which is like, I've seen this, I've talked about for like trapping monkeys. Like you put like a food in, like a piece of banana or something like in a trap, and then they try to grab it.
One weird trick to catch a raccoon.
And they do this, and then like his Billy's dad just runs out and like beats the raccoon to death with a club, like while it's holding on to this piece of tin. It's pretty savage. And his dad's like, okay, this raccoon's skin, like it's summer, its fur isn't great for anything. You shouldn't use this trapping technique anymore because it's kind of mean. You can use this pelt to train your dogs, and then you can only kill raccoons with your dogs. So mm-hmm. get on there. And then he just like spends some time training his dogs, teaching them all the raccoon tricks. And on the first night that he goes out for a hunt in hunting season, again, he hears his dogs like making noise as he lets them loose into the forest, and they've clearly identified where a raccoon is, and he's supposed to like make a yell back to them to like tell them to go for it. He's supposed to like whoop at them, like a hunter whoop or something. Mm-hmm. And he just starts crying. He's so happy. Like he can't even handle it, which is really cool. And like over time, he amasses a bunch of like raccoon hides, and his dad is like socking away all the money, and he doesn't even care what's happening to the money because he's just excited to be hunting.
Yeah, like the story of any child star.
Oh no, he is like a child star. That's exactly what happens, because the family gets all the money from the good hounds that he has. And there's like a couple like main anecdotes that come out of this hunting section. Like one is the first raccoon hunt. It's like he has to chop down this giant tree that the raccoon is in, and he almost like can't do it. It takes him like 3 days to chop it down.
Right.
I bring it up because, again, there's this sense of like providence throughout the book. Like he found the dog's names in a tree. He randomly discovered that magazine that had the dogs in it. And when he's worried that he can't chop this tree down because he's going to disappoint his dogs, he prays to God that he'll have the strength to knock the tree down, and then like a big wind comes by and knocks the tree over. And he's like, huh,
mm-hmm.
interesting.
Sure. Yeah, it's very much a sense of like, this was all meant to be. And that sort of threads throughout the story, and I think it's like it's implied by the first part too. Like,
yeah, certainly.
Where he as an adult is saying, like, here's a thing that happened to me. Like it all happened the way it was meant to happen, and it has influenced the way I am as an adult right now. And yeah, right.
So like there's another one that happens, like little Anne falls into a river during winter, and it's one of the first parts of the book where one of the dogs is in real danger. And of course, I am like waiting for this book to kill a dog the entire time that I'm reading this book. I'm just like, oh crap, when's it gonna happen?
When that's what this? You knew about the book going in. Like we announced we were reading it, and everyone was like, oh my god, where Redfern grows, it's grab so sad tissues. When the dog dies.
Yes. And so I'm just waiting for it to happen. And it's like the beginning of It's a Wonderful Life. Like Billy has to save his dog from the freezing river, and there's another moment of providence where he has his lantern, and he's using it to try and find her, but then like the handle all of a sudden falls down and he hears the metal of it and he goes, oh wait, I can use that to make a hook to like get little Anne's collar and like fish her out of the cold water. Mm-hmm. And then like for 3 days he leaves the lantern in his room and the handle never falls down on its own. And he's like, oh, it was providence. It was meant to be. Which I think that one's a little fuzzy. That's the one I don't believe. I believe the magic wind, like in fiction in this book, like that definitely happened. I think the lantern one felt like a bit of a stretch.
I mean, yeah, like that's I don't know if it's a parable or what it is about like a person comes by on a boat to save somebody whose house is flooded and they're like sitting on the roof and the guy says, oh, I'm waiting for God to save me.
Yeah.
And like sometimes God is just trying to like meet you halfway on stuff.
He is just trying to put some stuff out there for you to take care of it.
Sure.
I think, and that's some of what this book is doing, but Billy is working through like his own faith and being like, huh, maybe this stuff is put here for a reason. So then
how religious is the book? I don't remember that. Like how much
pretty explicit.
Okay, cool. Cause I seem to remember Billy like talking to God, like trying to save up the money and just, yeah. And that's part of where the like fatalistic aspect of the book comes from is
yes.
What does God want to happen, and how can I, Billy, work within that, I guess?
Yeah, very much so. The next thing is when this book really takes a turn for me, and this is the incident with the Pritchard boys. So at this point in the book, Billy's hounds are the talk of the town. They're the talk that he's such a good raccoon hunter. His grandpa's like got a little book where he makes notes of all the pelts that he brings in. Mm-hmm. And these two jerky boys, Reuben and Rainey, come in.
Not
Reuben,
like they don't prank call people,
no.
Right?
No, but they are jerky boys.
Uh-huh.
And they're always beating people up and making bad bets with people. And they come in at Grandpa's shop, and they're bullying Gramps, and they're bullying our boy Billy. And one of them is like, hey, let's make a bet. I bet that your fantastic dogs can't tree our ghost coon, which is this like raccoon that is notorious for escaping people. And when the phrase that I learned in this book that I'd never heard before, never reading like a book about hunting dogs, is you tree a raccoon.
Yeah.
Which is the dogs like chase a raccoon such that it thinks the only thing it can do is climb up a tree to get safe, which if it didn't have a human working with the dogs, it would be safe.
But then the human comes along and chops the tree down, as happened in that earlier story. And
yes,
Bob's your uncle. You got a dead raccoon.
Yeah, or you like climb up the tree and you scare the raccoon out, and then your dogs catch it. Or you have a gun and you like shoot the raccoon out of the tree or something.
Jeez, okay.
And these two jerky boys, like they bet Billy that his dogs can't catch this ghost raccoon. They take him out in the woods, and again, I'm waiting for these boys to do something bad to the dogs. Just waiting for it. And they finally tree the ghost raccoon, and Billy goes up there to try and knock him out, and he has a moment where he's like, I don't want to kill this raccoon that's like old and has a history and is kind of a legend. Like, he has a lot of respect for this raccoon in the moment. And in that exact moment, their dog, the Pritchard boys' dog, this big old hound, runs out there and gets in a dog fight with Billy's dogs. And it's getting pretty bad. And Billy like jumps down out of the tree. And one of the Pritchard boys, I think Rainey, is like, I'm going to kill your dogs if they hurt my dog. And he grabs Billy's axe. And Billy has this like two-sided axe, like he's like Gimli or something. And Rainey goes over the dogs, and he can't pull the axe out of the ground. He falls as he tries to do it. Billy breaks up the fight, and he turns back, and Rainey's brother Reuben is like shocked. He can't even speak. And he looks at Rainey. When Rainey fell trying to pick up the axe went into his stomach. And Rainey dies.
Oh, no.
And it's like this traumatic moment
I do remember this now.
We were just like hunting raccoons, and then all of a sudden a kid died.
Yeah,
and
he's from
a family we don't really like that doesn't really want any help from the community. So like we kind of just move on. There's a beat where Billy's like really sad about it, and he goes and he leaves some flowers on Rainey's grave, and then he feels better about it.
Mm-hmm.
But like everyone kind of moves on in a way that I thought was weird. It doesn't become a thing that haunts him the rest of the book. He watched a kid bleed out to death. I would have expected it to like hang with him a little longer, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, like I get that. Man, I guess the closest parallel I can think of in terms of literature is that family everybody hates from To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh, yeah. Like yes.
Yeah, that one that like keeps to itself.
The Yules. Yeah.
Yes, right. Not that that excuses like murdering a kid.
Well, he didn't murder him. It's like it's the kid was going to do a bad thing. And
manslaughtering a kid.
Yeah. It's
standing your ground a kid.
No, it's not what happened. Billy is real shook up about it, but then he like he goes and he leaves flowers, and then it's like a whole moment. But then a couple days later, Grandpa just totally changes the subject because he entered Billy and his dogs into a championship coon hunt, and the dogs are gonna enter this big contest because he was keeping track of how good they are at being dogs. And the dad and Billy and his grandpa go to this coon hunting championship. It is worth noting that before they leave, Billy hugs his mom goodbye and realizes that she's pregnant. He has been too busy hunting raccoons to realize that his mom is pregnant.
Okay.
That is called myopia, my dude.
I guess you're a 13 or 14 year old boy, like you are your own little world, especially if you have dogs who you are out tramping all over the place with.
That's true. And the contest is cool. It's a cool sequence. Like Billy gets treated like a grown up because his dogs are so great and people have heard of his dogs. Little Anne wins like a beauty contest, which is like a weird aside,
mm-hmm.
but okay. like a normal like dog show contest. And then they have this like adventure where there's only three teams left and there's a blizzard and Grandpa breaks his ankle and the dogs like maybe they like run off into the snow to try and get enough raccoons to win the challenge.
Right.
And there's like a little like there's some fear about what happens to the dogs. But they find them like covered in snow the next day, like around a tree where the last raccoon is needed for Billy to win the championship.
Uh-huh.
And all the men who lost show up to try and save to come find them in the blizzard. And then they go to the dogs. And there's this guy named Mr. Kyle who's like running the championship. And everybody's like, man, these dogs, like, how do they manage to stay alive in the snow just because they were hunting raccoons? Like, do they really love this boy that much? And Mr. Right. Kyle says, men, people have been trying to understand dogs ever since the beginning of time. One never knows what they'll do. You can read every day where a dog saved the life of a drowning child or lay down his life for his master. Some people call this loyalty. I don't. I may be wrong, but I call it love, the deepest kind of love. It's a shame that people all over the world can't have that kind of love in their hearts. There will be no wars, slaughter, or murder. No greed or selfishness. It will be the kind of world that God wants us to have. A wonderful world. So, like, maybe if we were all dogs, the world would be better?
That's beautiful. I guess if you accept the premise, which is that the saddest kind of death is when your dogs die.
Yeah.
Then the greatest kind of love would be when a dog
loves you.
Likes you because you feed it.
when a dog loves you, when a dog loves you enough to almost freeze to death to help you win a coon hunting contest.
Right. That's the greatest love of all.
That's the greatest love of all. I don't think that there would be no war, slaughter, or murder if we were all dogs, because, like, the dogs still kill the raccoons and, like, fight other
animals.
Yeah,
but they aren't, like, nuking the raccoons.
That's true. True.
Like, they dogs, they can't invent and work tools. So.
That is correct. That's correct.
Yeah.
So they win this championship. They get $300 for it, which is a lot of money.
Nice. That's pretty good return on investment, right? For your $40 dogs.
Well, and he's also been making all this other money the whole time that we don't even know about.
Right.
And it makes Mama very happy. She's very happy. And
what you and, got, you, I, obviously everybody has to invest in dog futures.
That's true. That's true. Because the there was like a burst, the bubble burst, but now like you get in on the ground floor and then dogs are going to be hot again in a couple of years and you
right.
buy all
yeah,
these
yeah,
dog
yeah,
futures.
Yeah. Buy low, sell high.
On dogs, yes. And Billy's not sure why his mom is so happy about the money, but she's very happy about it. So smash cut to 3 weeks later, you know, he wins the championship, but all he really wants to do is run through the woods hunting with his dogs, and he's back at it again.
Mm-hmm.
They don't tree a raccoon this time, Andrew. They tree a mountain lion.
Bad move, dogs.
And this is where the book gets to the sad part. So if you're, like, upset about dogs getting hurt, like, it's okay if you bail.
I'm sorry about this entire podcast so far.
So they tree this mountain lion and it becomes like a fight scene. Like, I don't know if you remember that scene from Homeward Bound: Incredible Journey where there's a cougar, but they don't fight that thing. They just kind of run for it. I think Chance like jumps on a rock and like seesaws the mountain lion away.
Sure.
But this time the dogs have to actually fight it and they're like locking onto its neck and clawing at it and getting clawed. Billy brings his axe into the fight. And like axes
that old, the old kid killer.
he axes the lion in the back. The lion jumps at him, but the dogs take one for the team, of course, because they rule.
Because they're the greatest. That's the greatest love of all.
And they definitely kill the lion. Old Dan has locked his jaw so tightly onto the lion's throat that like Billy has to pry it open with his axe. Mm-hmm. Like, that is how serious Dan is about killing this lion.
Mm-hmm.
And both of the animals, both of the dogs, Dan and Little Ann, are like bleeding. They're not doing great, but we're going to get home. They're doing, maybe they'll be okay. And this was really sad and gruesome. Do you remember this, Andrew?
I do remember.
Image
I remember
that I'm getting to
100%, and I'm just going to let you.
So like, so Billy is like letting the dog kind of run around. He's patched up old Dan as best he can with like leaves and mud and stuff. And then he notices that like Dan hasn't shown back up, and Little Ann leads him over there, and he's like stuck to a bush.
Yeah,
because his belly was cut, and like the book uses the word entrails.
Yep, entrails.
Are stuck on this bush, and Billy like shoves it back into the dog and then brings the dog home, and then his mom has to try and shove them back in and like clean them and sew the dog up, but it doesn't take, and the dog dies, and it's very sad. And then Little Ann,
like, that one is very sad, and then the next one is sadder somehow.
God. 'Cause then he buries old Dan. And he's very sad about it. And he makes a little coffin for his dog and he puts it in the ground. And then the next, like, Lil Ann won't eat anything. And he's trying to force food down his dog's throat. And, like, her eyes are different. She doesn't look good. And his mom's like, well, she doesn't have the will to live anymore. She has a broken heart. And Lil Ann, like, uses the last strength that she has to get to old Dan's grave. And just lie there like the coolest dog in the universe. And then she dies. And it's very sad. And no one's happy about it. And then this is where this Providence stuff comes back. Because the parents reveal that with the money from the competition and the money from all this, the pelts that they sold, they're going to be able to move closer into town.
Oh, right. And then it ends on like, actually good that your dogs died because they wouldn't have been happy in town.
And the kids are going to be able to go to school and learn how to be kids and have real jobs. And Billy's not super like, he's not on board. He actually is like, I don't buy this crap. He does buy when he goes to say goodbye to his dog Graves, and there is this red fern growing, and this is a legend, presumably a Cherokee legend. If you're
right, this is where the Native American
thing comes back. And it is like a legend of two children who like froze to death in winter, and then where they died, like a red fern growed, and that's like grew, and that's a
grew is the word.
And that's like a sacred place. And so now that there's this sacred red fern watching over where his dogs were, and he shows it to his mom, and they cry and come together over that moment. And he feels better about what happened, and looking back on it, he believes that it was always special.
At least the dogs died for a reason, Billy.
Yeah, that's a weird turn that the book takes, where it's not like...
Your dogs were meant to die the whole time.
Yeah, and I get, like, that is a thing that a lot of people find solace in a plan, right?
Yeah, of course, yeah. And then... Like, far be it for me to make light of that sort of... The everything happens for a reason, like... line of thinking for people who get strength from that.
Sometimes stuff just happens. Mm-hmm. And then if you end up in that place where it's like, oh, stuff just happened, it can be helpful to be like, well, what can I take from this? If this was meant to be, what am I supposed to carry forward into the rest of my life? Because I'm not the dead dog. I had a dog that died. So what do I move forward with? I don't know that I learned any lessons when my dog died, except that Santa Claus is a jerk. But certainly didn't like
Santa.
Get me,
why
get me into a
what
different
did I
school
do?
Or something? but it's a good book. I did not openly weep.
I was gonna ask, did you cry?
I got a little verklempt, but I did not openly weep.
Verklempt, eh?
Yeah, I was like a little just kind of choking up, but I was not like actually crying.
I haven't cried in a little over a year.
I think we talked about this on the Q&A.
Right. I think the last time I got verklempt was I was playing a particular part of the Mario game, and... I got a little verklempt about Days Gone By and lost childhood
and
stuff.
That hits you in the feels. I know that's your weak spot.
Sure.
That's your glowing weak spot.
That's my glowing weak point, yeah.
Childhood Days Gone By. But it is tough to watch this kid and read this kid, Billy, go through this stuff. And like, but what I do like about the framing, again, as I said at the top of the show, is that like, this is an experience that this adult had, and then he grew up, and then he lives a life. And if you're a kid reading this book, as we said, like, Rawls gave this book to a bunch of like middle school teachers basically and was like, read this book with your kids, like, it is useful to them. There is both a like, this is a thing that will happen to you. You will experience loss this way. That is normal, and there are things that you can learn from it or draw from it. And most people in the world will have also experienced something like this. And you can acknowledge that or not. Like, you can let that isolate you, or let that bring you together. There's something in the family of those jerk boys where they really don't connect with the rest of the community over that loss. And the book does just move on from that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's meant to be like a little bit of an indictment of that type of isolation, like, not, what is the word I'm looking for? Isolationist, like, mentality of like, we're our own. We just take care of our own. We don't want no help from nobody. And throughout the book, Billy is like amazed at when he sees people coming together, like, for good things.
Right.
And in particular, he is, like, really amazed at the groups of people who come together for the big contest and how well everybody treats each other and how excited they are for this thing that could have been, like, kind of like a nasty, like, who's this little kid with his dogs kind of moment.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, it's a good book. It's a sad book.
I think it's a staple for a reason.
Yes. And it is certainly effective. The prose alternates between pretty simple move the plot forward stuff. Like, it's just fun to read about Billy, like, running around with his dogs, and then it'll get a little purple when it's dealing with some of the more providence based stuff or kind of the like big emotional high points.
Right. But yeah, I mean, I think it's affecting without being too like emotionally manipulative about it. Like, I think that the sad beats are earned beats.
Oh yeah. And he spent, there's so much time in this book that's just like him enjoying being with his dogs that like it doesn't feel manipulative. I think that's why it doesn't feel manipulative, because you're just like, hey, he's just hanging out with his dogs and it's like cool, and they're smart, clever dogs, and they surprise everyone with how good they are at hunting. And he just has fun times with them.
Mm-hmm.
I am surprised at how many raccoons live in these woods. they kill a lot of raccoons with only a passing mention to the idea of scarcity, and I just don't know enough about hunting raccoons to know, but it feels like maybe they should have run out of them.
I gotta think, like, if you're like out in the woods, there are probably plenty of raccoons.
That's fair. But he does, like, during the contest, he does, like, the first round go to a spot where, like, other people haven't been.
Sure.
Because there will be raccoons over there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's Where the Referent Grows. It's a pretty good book. You should probably, if you're a listener who like has kids, you should probably like look forward to them reading this book.
Look forward to reading this book about dogs dying to them. Good recommendation, Craig.
Whatever. It's a book they should read, probably. If you have a story about how this book made you cry, you can send it to us. We will read them. We would love to share them as appropriate. Hit us up on social media at twitter.com/overduepod or facebook.com/overduepod. We also have an email at overduepod@gmail.com. Excuse me. A bunch of folks reached out to us in the past week, a lot in response to our Harry Potter episode, and our store as well. So I want to thank just a portion of them. Plenty of whom were also excited about this month's books. So Morgan, Christine, Mr. J, Asma, Britt, Mrs. WT, Caitlin, Rebecca, Meg, Ryan, Nikki, Rob, Kara, Valerie,
Wait,
Cheyenne.
Meg Ryan.
Meg and Ryan. Oh, also Michael Scott. Michael Dion, Trisha, Elise, Leslie, Melissa, Jamie, Emily, Rachel, Mary Kate, Jacqueline, Adrian, Danielle, Joan, and many more. Thank you all for interacting with us online. And keeping the conversations about the episodes going. Andrew, if folks want to know more about the show, where should they go?
They should go to overduepodcast.com, which is where we have links to iTunes and RSS and Stitcher. All ways you can subscribe to the show. I think if you use Spotify and you listen to the podcast through that, we are also up on there if you want to search for it. I don't know if we can get a link to add to the site, but I guess I could look into that now in retrospect. And again, we have our merch store going for the next couple weeks. That's overduepodcast.com/store. We ship things about once a week. So we usually put up notifications on Twitter just before we ship a new round of things. So if you are interested in getting stuff ahead of the holiday season, pay attention to that. Place your order soon, because, you know, it's a temporary thing. We enjoy doing this, but also it takes like 2 hours every time we get together to pack stuff up. So
yep.
It's not a thing we're gonna do all the time. But next week I am reading Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Whoop whoop.
Which is by Douglas Adams, right?
Yep, that's true.
Cool. So until we see you then, everybody, try to be happy.
Yeah.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.